the bells of Canterbury Cathedral are pealing a joyous tune. Clanging high up in the cathedral's tower, their rich music rings out across the rooftops of the English city. It carries far and wide across the winter countryside. The people of Canterbury, scurrying around in the frosty streets and bartering with traders in the marketplace, stop what they're doing to hear them ring. Babies cry as they're startled by the loud noise. Dogs bark with excitement. Something big is happening. Henry III is here in Canterbury on this January day in 1242. So is his wife, Queen Eleanor of Provence. They've come down here specially with a large crowd of English barons and their wives and families to witness the occasion. Now it's almost here, they can barely contain their anticipation. It's a homecoming. Henry's younger brother, Richard Earl of Cornwall, has been away for more than a year on crusade. It took him nearly 4 years of saving and planning to be ready for it, but in late 1240, he went off to the east to do battle with the Sultan of Egypt. Now he's home to tell his tales, and Henry is here to meet him. For Henry, the minutes must seem to pass as slowly as hours. He and Richard have had their differences in the past, but he loves his brother dearly. Henry's also a very pious Christian, becoming more pious with every passing year. So to have a proper crusader in the family, it's a dream come true. When Richard finally appears, marching in triumph up the road from Dover, where he's docked his ships, Henry can't contain himself any longer. He runs to his brother and throws his arms around him. There's a great clapping of backs and tears of joy. Richard is whisked off with Henry and Eleanor to rest up after his long journey. Henry being Henry, he overwhelms Richard with lavish gifts to celebrate his homecoming. And in return, he's going to want to hear all about his adventures. Oh, and there's one more thing Henry's going to want in return. One teeny-weeny favour Henry's going to ask Richard now that the great crusader is back. But we'll come to that in a minute. For Richard, this must be rather flattering. No doubt about it, he's had a good crusade. He left England in 1240 in terrible spirits. His wife, Isabella Marshall, daughter of the great knight William Marshall, had died giving birth to their fourth child. Meanwhile, his brother Henry had upset all the barons by letting his current BFF, Simon de Montfort, marry his and Richard's sister Eleanor in secret. So Richard was glad to get away. Even better, when he arrived in the East, he was welcomed like a hero and pretty much acted like one. In an amazing stroke of good luck, the old Sultan Al-Kamil turned out to be dead, and Richard played off his squabbling successors to win loads of political concessions for the Crusader kingdom. They rebuilt the vital border castle at Ascalon and did a big prisoner swap that got back a lot of captured Christians in exchange for some Muslim prisoners. There were no epic battles, but that was okay. After leaving the Holy Land, Richard was cheered all his way home. In Italy, one town greeted him with their band playing a tune mounted on the back of an elephant. When he stopped off at the court of the German Emperor Frederick Hohenstaufen, who's married to his sister, he was treated to trips to the hot baths and performances by semi-naked dancing girls. Not a bad rebound tour. And now here he is, home to see his big brother, who's lavishing him with gifts as usual. But why, Richard may ask, is Henry being quite so generous? Henry's offering him hundreds of pounds in cash, 4 very smart manor houses, and even a brand new wife, Queen Eleanor's younger sister Sanchia. This is all very nice, and Richard is happy to accept. But there must be some strings attached. There are. And little by little, the story comes out. While Richard's been away, Henry has been getting ideas in his head. Familiar ideas, but also dangerous ones. They concern old Plantagenet territories in France, specifically the county of Poitou, which was snatched by the French years ago. Henry reckons he's seen an opportunity to grab it back by going into alliance with some members of his and Richard's extended family. If this is already sounding dodgy to you, well, that's because it is. Never mind the bells of Canterbury Cathedral, what should be ringing in Richard's ears are alarm bells. But with Henry flattering his ego and filling his pockets, he can't resist. He really should know better. This is the start of yet another one of Henry's fiascos, which sooner or later will put the Plantagenet kingdom into a tailspin. I'm Dan Jones, and from Sony Music Entertainment, this is History. Season 4 of A Dynasty to Die For. Episode 4, Simon Says. The world's full of people celebrating their successes, but if the Plantagenets have taught us anything, it's that failing is much more interesting. So that's why I'm certain you're going to love the podcast How to Fail. The very brilliant Elizabeth Day invites guests on to talk about three of their biggest failures and what they've taught them about life. It's a great way to hear a new side to people you may think you know. Guests include Bernie Sanders, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and Stanley Tucci. Give it a try. Find How to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. People don't call Henry Vir Simplex, a simple man or even a simpleton, for nothing. What happens in the year 1242 is a case in point. To understand what's going on, I'd better give you a bit more of the backstory on what went down in Poitou. Poitou is a bit of France between Gascony and Normandy. It was once a heartland of the Plantagenet Empire and the location of Eleanor of Aquitaine's capital. If you want to relive those glory days, I highly recommend going back to season 1 of this podcast. Anyway, since the very much non-glory days at the end of King John's reign, Poitou has been overrun by the French. And despite Henry's best efforts and general indignation, it's been impossible to get it back. But now, Henry sees a chance. His and Richard's mum, Isabella of Angoulême, has remarried into a family called the Lusignans, who are based in southwest France, right on the borders of Poitou. Isabella and Hugh of Lusignan have had a whole brood of kids. That means Henry and Richard have a shedload of relatives over there who they don't really know that well. But now Henry's been in touch with them, and he reckons they're up for a deal to help take Poitou back in a war against the French King Louis IX. Now, bear in mind that no matter who the English have allied with since the death of Richard the Lionheart more than 40 years ago, they've never been able to lay a glove on the kings of France. But Henry isn't thinking about that. Henry reckons the Lusignans are good people. So in 1242, he asks his barons in England for a load of tax and their help in fighting the war. He gets Richard to sign up the minute he's home from the Holy Land. And Henry also wants Simon de Montfort by his side. Their friendship went through a rocky patch recently when he noticed Simon was using the kingdom's credit card a little too freely, and Simon stormed off on his own crusade. But Henry knows his old friend is just who you want by your side on a campaign like this. So when he gets back, they patch things up, and Simon agrees to come along. It's a big gamble, but Henry has his heart set on getting Poitou back. It can't help that everyone else, including the French King Louis IX and his brother-in-law, the German Emperor Frederick Hohenstaufen, are building reputations as great warriors. Henry doesn't like being left out. And so it is that in the summer of 1242, he has a fleet fitted out to take him over to Poitou for a campaign. But almost from the minute he arrives, things start going wrong. There are basically three problems. Number one is that the Lusignans have led Henry up the garden path. They promised that if he came over, they'd rustle up a whole bunch of other enemies of King Louis IX as allies, but they don't. Henry does his bit, but the Lusignans don't do theirs. Problem number two is that Louis IX is no mug. In fact, he's growing up to be one of the all-round greatest kings in the history of France. He's so rich and pious that he will one day manage to get hold of Christ's actual crown of thorns for his private relic collection. In war, he's happy to fight all comers, at home or away on crusade. He's more than a match in battle for Henry, who's barely raised a fly swat in anger all his life. The third problem is, well, Henry. It's a vir simplex thing. He's off with the fairies. When he arrives in France, instead of throwing himself all out into the war, he fritters his time away, checking out the pretty architecture of the towns he visits, and shelling out cash earmarked for weapons and soldiers' wages on charitable acts like feeding thousands of paupers. Henry talks a good game. He writes home at one point to his ministers in England to say that he's going to either recover his honour in parts across the sea, or should that not happen, incur perpetual ignominy and irreparable loss. But this feels like it's only going one way. And so his campaign goes nowhere fast, until the crunch comes in July 1242. By now, Henry has one military objective: to defend a bridge not far from the town he's using as his headquarters, a place called Saintes. He has to stop Louis taking that bridge, so he tries to make an alliance with the local lord whose castle overlooks the bridge, a man called Geoffrey de Rancon. But it turns out that Geoffrey de Rancon won't touch Henry with a barge pole. He has some legacy beef with the Lusignans, which runs so deep that he's vowed not to cut his hair until he's had revenge on them. Then, when Louis IX turns up with his army, it's way bigger than Henry's. Just one look at it tells you fighting is futile. Henry sends his brother Richard with a white flag over the bridge to ask for a truce. Then he scarpers with the army back to Saintes. The next night, Louis simply strolls across the bridge unopposed. Henry's no general, to say the least. In the end, he even loses Saintes. He tries to pin the blame on his stepdad, Hugh de Lusignan, but Hugh won't hear a word of it. Henry tries to struggle on into 1243, but soon enough he has to sign a truce, formally handing over to Louis everything he's won. At this point, morale in Henry's army is collapsing, and rightly or wrongly, he's copping the blame. Simon de Montfort, Henry's brother-in-law and sometime flavour of the month Earl of Leicester, is on the campaign, and in an outburst that Henry will stew on for years afterwards, he lets him have it with both barrels. Simon rages at Henry that this is all his fault, and that he ought to be locked up like Charles the Simple. Simon's referring to a 10th century king who was notorious for having noble favourites, being hopeless in battle, and, as Simon points out, eventually being captured and jailed by his own subjects. Simon's pushing his luck, but then again, he's only saying what a lot of other English nobles have been thinking. How much more of Henry's bungling can they possibly put up with? After the embarrassing failure of the 1242 campaign, Henry comes back to England with his tail well and truly between his legs. He spent a ton of money on a complete waste of time. Yet, unlike his father John in 1214, he doesn't face calls for his head or a full-blown rebellion. Part of the reason is that, unlike John, he isn't cruel or personally spiteful. He doesn't inspire hatred, just more extreme exasperation. And actually, when Henry is doing things he's good at, he can be rather magnificent. Two of those things are monumental architecture and religious spectacle. And as the 13th century goes on, these are coming right into fashion as must-have qualities in a Christian king. In the time that Henry is on the throne, medieval Europe enters a golden period for church and cathedral building. There's a revolution in architecture and building, which sees Gothic cathedrals springing up across England and Wales. In Paris, Louis IX is building the astonishing Saint-Chapelle to house the Crown of Thorns I mentioned earlier. He's also turning the Abbey Church of Saint-Denis into a stunning mausoleum for all the kings of France. So after his humiliation in Poitou, Henry tries competing in that field instead. He turns his attention to a project it's impossible not to admire, not least because we can still see it today. It's as expensive as any foreign war, but it's a lot prettier to look at, and rather less deadly. Henry decides to fund and personally oversee the redevelopment of the greatest church in England, Westminster Abbey. He's going to turn it into a sort of three-in-one spiritual home for English monarchy. At the heart will be the shrine of Edward the Confessor, the very pious last king of the Saxons, whom Henry adores so much he named his eldest son after him. In front of the shrine will be the high altar where English monarchs are crowned. And around it will be royal tombs for the Plantagenets, starting with himself. Work on the Confessor's new shrine begins in 1241. The redevelopment of the church itself kicks off in 1245. The building involves almost entirely demolishing the original church built 300 years earlier. Then, hundreds of stonemasons, carpenters, structural engineers, labourers and more get cracking on putting up the new building. It's an incredibly daring piece of building work. The vaulted ceiling soars more than 100 feet high. Flying buttresses mean the outside walls can be almost impossibly thin, and the church inside vast and light. Some of the stone is dragged up on carts from Purbeck in Dorset, and some is imported from Normandy. The inside is lit up with beautiful stained glass, and the floor is paved by the finest artists in Europe. It's a huge project in every sense. Even though Henry has hundreds of workmen buzzing around the site every day, and even though he spends up to 10% of his annual budget every year, it's going to take more than 20 years to complete. But for Henry, it's worth it. This is the one bit of kingship he's really, really good at. And as the building is going on, he makes sure to keep reminding people what a mystical, fabulous undertaking this is. At one point, he manages to get hold of a relic he reckons is every bit as holy as Louis IX's crown of thorns. It's a vial of Christ's actual blood. In 1248, Henry parades this all the way from the Tower of London to Westminster before donating it formally to the Abbey, along with other relics he's hunted down, like St. Sylvester's arm, St. Anathasius's tooth, and a special stone on which Christ trod before he went up to heaven. More on Henry's relic collecting on this week's subscriber episode. Although the Abbey Church is still a building site at this point, the gifting of Jesus' blood is still a fantastic power move for Henry, and manages to put him on a par with Louis IX, in the same year that the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris is being consecrated so it can house the Crown of Thorns. Henry's never going to go toe-to-toe with the big boys of Europe on the battlefield, but in the architect's studio and the church pew, he's a match for just about anyone. If only building churches and prancing about with test tubes full of holy bodily fluids was enough. But sadly for Henry, it's not. And that's why, once Henry has recovered his poise from the debacle in Poitou, he's ready to get going with some more of his trademark simple-minded bungling. This fresh batch of trouble starts brewing in the year 1250. It comes from several directions at once. In the first place, tension has been creeping into English politics thanks to Henry's extended family on his mum's side, the Lusignans. Dozens of them have come over to England. They're taking advantage of Henry's notoriously overgenerous nature and upsetting the rest of the barons as they do. At the same time, there's trouble down in Gascony, where the locals are not happy with the man Henry has sent down there to rule on his behalf, his sometime bosom pal and brother-in-law Simon de Montfort, whom we last heard telling Henry he belonged in jail. And finally, trouble comes from Henry himself. In 1250, Louis IX of France has been out in Egypt for nearly 2 years, leading the armies of Christendom on a crusade against the Sultan there. It's a bloody, dramatic, spectacular crusade, and as we'll hear, the stories that come back are enough to make your hair stand on end. It feels like a battle for the soul of the world, and Henry can't bear missing out on it. So in 1250, he does something that he's really not suited to do. He takes the cross, and declares that he is going on crusade as well. Henry's already spending a fortune rebuilding Westminster Abbey. He really can't afford a crusade, and he's also proven himself many times over to be just about the last person you would want in charge of an army. But Richard has been, Louis has been, Henry's insistent that he wants to go too. It's a big mistake. And its consequences will lead Henry into the maddest, most destructive and dangerous phase of his long and turbulent reign. But that's for next time, on This Is History. If you can't wait for more Plantagenet action, a reminder that the next episode is already out over on This Is History Plus, where you can listen ad-free alongside hours of subscriber-only content, where I chat with my producer about the Middle Ages. This time, we find out about one very unusual way medieval nobles tried to protect women in childbirth. It might put you off pork scratchings forever. To subscribe, go to Apple Podcasts and click Try Free, or head to thisishistorypod.com to start your free trial today.